So it gives me tremendous pleasure to introduce you to the third episode of If These Walls Could Talk, a Strictly DLMDD production. My name is Jeremy Newton. By day, I'm the head of agency business at DLMDD, a sonic branding agency based in London. And by night, I'm a music obsessive, a DJ, and a lover of history, amongst other things. Having been born and raised in London, I've always been fascinated and inspired by this city's contribution to music and culture. So much has taken place here that has affected and galvanized so many. Scenes from rave to rock and roll, from jazz to jungle, from punk to grime, and everything in between. There is undoubtedly something in the somewhat polluted air that enables musicians and people to create, thrive, and express themselves with an authenticity and a swagger in a way that is unique and original to London. The aim of this podcast is to try and delve into this energy through its iconic music venues. The focus is to showcase and celebrate these spaces and unearth the narrative, the personalities, and the anecdotes that have contributed to a venue's legend. And we have a very, very special episode lined up for you today. A venue steeped in history and legend, a space that has always championed counterculture in many guises, be it the hippie movement, punk or rave. A venue that has been graced by some of music's most legendary names. A venue that has consistently reinvented itself for coming up to 200 years. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Roundhouse. To help tell the story, we're very lucky to be joined by the Roundhouse CEO and Artistic Director Marcus Davey. It's head of music Lucy Wood and head of technical and production Ruth Butler. Welcome all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here, and there's so much to discuss. Just to set the scene, the Roundhouse in its very first incarnation, it's 1864. I've got like visions of Victorian and Dickensian London. The London Underground is in its infancy, and a train engine maintenance shed is being built in Chalk Farm.
It was actually 1846,
okay.
And it opened in 1847 as a steam engine maintenance shed. It was brand new technology of the day. So
right.
Like a new mobile phone or smartphone nowadays, you change them quite often.
Yep.
This beautiful building only lasted 8 years. Only lasted
wow.
8 years as a steam engine maintenance shed. It could hold 23 being repaired and one being turned, but then shunted off back onto the line.
Okay, and is that because the trains outgrew the size of the space?
I think there's a number of reasons. One of them is it's trains started becoming longer, but they also found that maintaining them was much easier if you just had like a barn-like structure. You put them in one end and you took them at the other end, and it's
right,
much
okay.
quicker and more simple. Also, this wasn't the great location to do it. You know, in Chalk Farm, it's on the outskirts of Euston, and
right.
you know, they either wanted to do them further out. It's for the Birmingham to London railway.
Okay,
and you know,
so would the train come into Euston?
Well, interestingly, there's a hill coming up out of Euston, and there's a winding mechanism to get the engines. So it wasn't just the steam engine going straight in. There's a winding mechanism with ropes and pulleys and stuff like
oh,
that
wow.
pulled it into this area.
Okay, and that was like at the forefront of technology at the time?
Forefront of technology, yeah.
Wow. So that kind of sets the scene for the building's birth. And then kind of, it wasn't really a music venue for almost 100 years thereafter, was it? So... We'll flash through 1864 to early 60s. I mean, obviously a lot happened, but I mean, it was obviously it was only used as you say 7 years.
Yeah. And then it was a potato store for a local farmer,
okay.
grain, and then Gilby's, which were massive in the area, making gin and spirits.
Right.
And but it became a bonded warehouse, which means a government bonded warehouse
okay.
for whiskies, gins, and spirits. Which then would they would. Under bond would take all that amazing merchandise all over what was then the British Empire.
Right.
And it all came from here.
Wow.
And it lasted about 100 years. And then they realised that actually this is quite valuable land around here and they didn't want to stay in the area. So they moved out of London.
Right.
And then it became redundant again. And it was going to be knocked down, but somebody saved it. And an amazing local businessman called Louis Mintz gave it to the playwright Arnold Wesker, who had set up a company, a theatre company called Company 42.
Right.
42, if I can ramble on for this for another couple of
ramble
seconds.
Ramble away, please.
The 42 comes from the Trade Union Congress of 1961, where resolution number 42 was to bring the arts and the people closer together through the trade unions.
Wow.
And Arnold Wesker, who was an eminent playwright, ended up being Sir Arnold Wesker, had this vision for a company, and then they wanted a home, and this became the home.
Oh, wow.
There was never enough money to really do the building properly.
So was he a local resident? Did he live in the area? Or
I think he might have done. I think he just knew the Minces, and
okay.
then they said, you know, well, I've got this old building on that land that we're
amazing.
Developing further down, and why don't you take that for a while? And then it turned into what it was.
Amazing. So Arnold Wesker spearheaded
yeah.
The initial roundhouse.
Yes, but he did, and then it just didn't work financially. And this is quite a funny story. There was the government of the day said, we need some proper business going in here and sorting it all out. And a man called George Hoskins was brought in, and he had been the chairman of the Egg Marketing Board as a kind of proper Whitehall man with a bowler hat, came in with his suit and soon went native into the roundhouse and got really into the kind of vibe.
Amazing. And this is in like swinging 60s London.
This was 67, 68. I mean, okay. Around that time, of course, the roundhouse reopened with an amazing night, which was the launch of the International Times, a counterculture magazine newspaper. And people came from all over the place to come and see it. Paul McCartney was dressed up as a Turk, Marianne Faithfull as a nun. Loads of other incredible celebrities of the day were there. Soft Machine, who are the big band of the day, gave a kind of evening performance. And it was a young local band who had done a few student unions who gave their first major gig, and they performed all night. And it was kind of really the kind of birth of psychedelia.
Right,
it was a band called The Pink Floyd.
Oh, wow. Whatever happened to them?
Yeah, what happened to the you know? But Nick Mason, who was in it then, has remained an ambassador and supporter of ours in so many generous and wonderful ways, even just this week, and has been so connected with us ever since.
Amazing. Yeah. But that seems to be a recurring theme in terms of the people who are involved in the roundhouse and the personalities and the locals. You know, we were given a tour earlier and they showed us all the plinths.
Mm.
With all of the names on, and they spoke about the Mintz family and all of the different names. I saw George Harrison on there, so it does seem like a venue that equates to kind of people becoming very loyal and connected to it, which seems to be a recurring theme.
It gets under your skin. Gets into you. I don't think even if you leave, you never truly leave. You leave a bit of your heart here.
Oh, that's good.
That's for sure.
And Ruth, you know, I think it's fair to say you once left and you came back again.
Yeah, very quickly.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I've been here a fair few years, but in various different guises. Started as a freelancer and then all the way through. But
amazing.
Yeah, it definitely gets into your skin, this place. Yeah.
As a music fan, just seeing and being involved in the performances must be really exciting, but also kind of being part of something that culturally allows people to grow and evolve and, you know.
I think that's also what you were saying about people having that sort of loyalty and feeling about it. Lots of the people who are our alumni, you know, people who've come through our youth programs, I guess we'll talk about that a bit more, have real loyalty for us because we're the place where they started their careers. I mean, artists, members of the music industry, broadcast industry, kind of honed their craft in our building. And I think that it feels like home for them, you know.
It counts for a lot. It means more, doesn't it? And we'll come on to the trust later, but kind of going back to the 60s, I imagine we'll kind of dovetail from time to time. But going back to the 60s, obviously London was a very exciting place. And just reeling off some of the names of the bands and the performers who have played here. Obviously you mentioned Pink Floyd, but Jimi Hendrix, David Bowie, the Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, you know, Jim Morrison.
Yeah, I got a little story about that.
Please share it.
So the Doors gave three nights in Britain, one at the Isle of Wight Festival and two at the Roundhouse. But they
were, was that in 69?
68.
68.
And they did a double bill with Jefferson Airplane.
Wow.
And they had an agreement that one night Jefferson Airplane would go first and then the Doors would go second. The first night, the Doors went first and the Jefferson Airplane, and apparently it was a pretty grotty gig from people I'd know who went there. And the second night they turned it around, got their act together, and there's an ITV film of it, of the gig. And it's extraordinary. You know, all the songs you know were being performed here for the first time, and that's the only performances they did in a venue in Britain.
Wow. That is.
When you say if these walls could talk or walls could sing, you know, you do. I don't know if you guys find this, but sometimes you go in there and I'd always catch myself and think, can you imagine what it'd be like to work in there? Oh, I do work here. And then it's kind of, can you imagine just being. And sometimes I kind of feel that it sounds a bit weird, but, you know, I can feel presence of something
100%.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, that energy and that spirit and that kind of that history, it's tangible, right?
Yeah.
It's a tangible thing. I mean,
they used to say, because I think there were quite a lot of drugs in those days, which there are definitely not now, that if you licked the walls, you could be high for several days.
Right, okay. But maybe I'll try that on my way out.
Yeah, I think you'll probably get a little bit of brick dust. Do not try this at home, kids.
Because I was reading some stuff about, obviously, like LSD. LSD was only made illegal in, like, what, 67 or 68? in terms of like the Roundhouse and counterculture and obviously psychedelia, I think that was kind of...
I think it went hand in hand. And, you know, we're at a time at the moment, we're talking at the moment when there are untold horrors going on in the world and appalling wars. But Allen Ginsberg held a conference here for 2 weeks in July 67. I was born in July 67. Wow. And it was called The Dialectics of Liberation. And it's about how we can free ourselves from the tortures that we put ourselves through. I've heard some of the recordings, and Stokely Carmichael gave his very famous Black Power speech. And Allen Ginsberg was, when people were getting irate and, you know, talking about, you know, whatever, he would say, free yourself, you know, calm down, let go of it all. And it feels so desperate at the moment that we need to bring people together and somehow, you know, even saying that seems futile and stupid. But it was interesting that in 1967, Vietnam War, all the other things that had been around at that sort of time, that there was a group of poets and artists and coming together to try and think about a different view for the future.
Well, it's kind of refreshing and scary that those problems are still here today, but also people are trying to deal with it in a similar way through the arts and through music and through live music. So there is like an escapism and a way out in some people's minds. Wow. So some of the other kind of like notable gigs in the 60s, what else comes to mind with...
Oh, you put me on the spot now.
Nobody said Patti Smith. I love Patti Smith. Thank you.
Oh, that was May 1976. Sorry, I'm going to start talking like that. That was May 1976. It was her first performance in Britain, and it was a prelude to the big Ramones gig,
right,
and Stranglers as well. So that punk stuff. I think, you know, the Ramones came over, did their first gig here on the 4th of July, 1976, and in the audience were some of the young musicians who would then become the Sex Pistols, the Pogues, and, you know, the Clash and whatever. I think some of them broke through the roof to get in.
Oh,
and
wow.
The Ramones helped them in through, you know.
Love that.
And you can't do it now, guys. and there's a real feeling that psychedelia, 10 years later, punk, and a number of years later, from that kind of free expression and do-it-yourself attitude came grime, came spoken word poetry. I mean,
it's all interlinked in the same kind of, you know.
And radical theatre as well.
Yeah. My initial association was just as a music venue, but some of the theatre and some of the playwrights and some of the actors who have kind of come through here as well, it's phenomenal, just kind of like seeing the names on the flyers.
Yeah, I'm sorry I'm doing too much talking, but I think I'm the old one. Nicole Williamson doing Hamlet and, you know, Marianne Faithfull as Ophelia in that production, Helen Mirren and Terence Stamp. I was once showing him around about 15 years ago. And there was a poster with him on it, his name on it.
I saw that in the cafe.
Exactly.
Morning, yeah.
And he went, oh, I love those days. You know, I was out in the car with Michael with the roof down, picking up birds, is what he said. And I said, oh, it's Michael. He said, shared a flat with Michael Caine.
Amazing.
And it was just so funny.
Moving back to like the architecture, one thing that really interests me about the space is obviously it wasn't designed as a music venue initially, was it? So, from a technical standpoint, it would be interesting to ask you, Ruth, how the building overcame that and the work that needed to be done to kind of turn it into a world-class music venue from an audio point of view.
Yeah, so it kind of done performance in all sorts of guises for many decades. But in the 2004-06 refurb, that was when it became the kind of Roundhouse as we know and love it now.
Right.
But of course, it's a listed space. It's two-star listed. Can't touch any of the
So you're super limited in terms of what you can do from structurally.
Structurally and all that. Yeah. So any kind of original ironwork, we have to be quite protective about. And the Victorians, in the wonderful way, have made this most glorious ornate building. We can't touch any of it. Can't touch any of it for very good reasons. We want the Roundhouse to last forever, but it does make it slightly more complicated in that kind of whenever you get a found space and trying to turn it into a venue, there's quite a lot of work that has to be done. So unlike a lot of theatres that have a fly floor and bars that fly in and out, we do not. We have trusses and hoists and all of that, and everything is slung from what we call the ring beams in the roof.
Right.
And there's concentric RSJs at various different diameters in the roof, and you sling bridles through from the ring beams down to the hoist, and at that point you can do your truss. Wow. And at that point you can do your lighting and sound and all of that. So it's great. You're constantly working in 3D. You're always in three dimensions.
Yeah.
Whereas kind of trad theatre's got a cross arch and you're quite 2D.
Right, okay.
You have to think in the 3D way all the time. And of course, acoustics are a nightmare, a brilliant and nightmarish kind of thing. Yeah. So I think with kind of experienced performers, it's much less of a thing. But whenever we've got kind of our poetry slam or kind of our younger, almost greener performers, we have to give them some kind of prolonged time on stage because they're just not used to that bounce back.
Yeah.
If you've got a poet doing a really lovely moment, but they're hearing themselves kind of 2 seconds behind and it really throws them off. So we've got a real reliance on monitors, therefore. We do what we can to make sure that people are kind of comfortable in that space a little bit.
That's really interesting in terms of like the experienced performers versus the inexperienced performers in the space performing.
Yeah. Well,
and how they change or alter their performance and how comfortable they are with that process based on their experience.
Yeah, I mean, even some of the ones that are long in the tooth are kind of thrown by it, I would say. But especially if we, kind of our traditional setup is still quite end-on. So anyone that comes to a music gig here will see an end-on stage. For our more bespoke stuff, maybe our more kind of artistic program, things like that, we might put stage in the middle. And so suddenly you're expecting someone that might be used to end-on, but having to kind of constantly rotate in their performance. And that can be a real thing as well. So just having a bit of an awareness that sometimes this found space factor needs a bit of extra time, a little bit of extra thought. And we work really closely with our producers, therefore, to kind of go, what does it require for that performer to make their best out of the show?
So each performance must have completely different requirements based on the instruments, based on the vocalist, based on the lineup of the band, and you've got to tailor to that. That must be really interesting.
Yeah, it really is. And particularly for our own programmes, so In the Round and our music programmes in particular, we've got a really lovely 13-metre, and this is where I get really geeky, really lovely 13-metre circular stage, which can accommodate huge amounts of people or can accommodate a kind of solo artist in front of a piano. But how we light them is really important. How they face, we'll have a kind of 270-degree seating structure around them. But of course, we've got to think about sight lines and how best to make that. And just, it's all about the presentation of that performance. And because we're the Roundhouse, we can advise best on that a little bit.
Of course.
So we work really closely with our incoming, whoever that is, our incoming clients, artists, whatever that is, just to go, you know, this is fan space vibe. So we can work with you and make the most of it.
That's
cool. Do you find that quite a lot of the artists and audiences and production crews say, yeah, it's always the Roundhouse, but it feels different every time. Because you can make it, it's a like a blank space, which is a very beautiful and urban, gritty blank space, but you can make something out of it which you couldn't do anywhere else. And you get, like if you do an In the Round circus, or like a Fuerza Bruta, which is an amazing Argentinian immersive theatre circus dance company, or one of the concerts in the round, which is seated, and then a gig, which is not. It can be quite disorientating for people, I think. But I think that's part of the suspending the disbelief, you know, the Shakespearean thing of like you have to kind of move away from real life if you want to access that bit inside, which is going to take you to somewhere else.
Beautifully put, yeah.
I try.
I was thinking when Ruth was talking about, like, we get quite a lot of underplays, you know, sort of bigger artists who would, you know, they could sell far more tickets than you can sell here coming and playing here because of, you know, our reputation and because they love the space so much. And the work that Ruth's team does in trying to sort of jam basically arena shows into a round ex-industrial venue. I mean, I think that takes so much sort of care and attention and sort of making that fit with what we've got and what they've got.
I do an awful lot of saying, no, you're 40-metre pyro can't happen here. I'm really sorry. Maybe an 8-metre might be slightly more appropriate. We've got a wooden roof and that
is
might
that
not
because
fly.
They're used to doing arenas.
Yeah, exactly, because they're kind of roof-off arena shows.
So for the uninitiated, an underplay is like, what is that, like a bigger band playing in a smaller venue?
Give us an example, Lucy.
Radiohead or The Strokes or
Jay-Z.
Jay-Z, yes. Wow. Burner Boy, you know, there's a few of them that we've had in the time that I've been here. Those are the ones I can think of.
Amazing. What struck me most about the space, having been to many a gig here and having gone in there without any punters, is how small it seems without people in the crowd. My memory of it is much bigger than it was without any punters inside or, you know, performers or that kind of
stuff. It has Time Lord technology.
Yeah.
I think when you open that door and you're confronted with 2,500 downstairs and 500 odd upstairs, you have no clue that it's actually probably only 35 metres across. You know, you kind of open that door and go, wow, this sea of people having the most incredible time. And then you go in when it's kind of, the doors have been open all day and it's cold. And
It's have you ever stood on the stage, either of you, looked at the audience?
Yeah.
What does that look like?
Not often, honest boss.
Yeah, I heard you sing that time.
It's amazing, of course. I mean, for, again, a bit techie, but for music shows, we have a 4-foot stage. So it's a real nice height to be able to see across a crowd. For a stood audience, you want people at the back to be able to see. But of course, in reverse, you can see the sea of faces that goes on right to the back of the room. And they're all, I mean, there's quite a lot of phones up in now, but of course, everyone's just having the best time. And it's a thrill, right? We're so lucky to be in these jobs and so lucky to be doing what we do. And to go and see a bit of a glimpse of that. And one of my favourite things to do...
You've got any jobs going?
Yeah, I'll see you. One of my favourite things to do is stand on the bridges on level 2. So as you come out of the balcony, out of the circle, and you have to wend your way down to go out the main exit, but stand on one of those bridges and watch 3,000 people leave. It's just the most wonderful thing.
I totally agree. It's that thing standing up there and just watching. And sometimes the whole crowd is singing as they go down. They're singing one of the songs and that goes into the tube. I mean, I've been to gigs where, you know, I've been on the tube and everyone's singing along. It's incredible. But when we did the rebuild of the Roundhouse, the 2004-2006, we worked with the architect John McCaslin. And the whole idea was to pull all the services out of the Roundhouse to make it look as it used to look. And do as little interaction. Well, there's huge amounts of of new stuff in, you know, like you were talking about the technology inside. And it was, when we did the roof, it was the largest sound insulation job in the world.
So
it's 9 layers of insulation on that roof to stop the noise and break out. And it's just, you know.
So that was in between 2004, 2006.
Yeah.
So sort of going back in terms to the chronology of the building. Mm. So we've kind of touched on the 60s and the 70s loosely. And then, when did the building wasn't used as a music venue for the duration of the 80s?
Yeah, it became redundant in 83, and then the GLC, as in the Greater London Council and Camden Council, wanted to try and turn it into the first ever Black Arts Centre.
Right.
It's an amazing vision. Unfortunately, there wasn't enough. I suspect that Thatcher's Britain was slightly different to the kind of counterculture vision of what
of the 60s,
The 60s and even into the 80s of that kind of Black Arts Centre idea.
Yeah.
And it was redundant. There were a few bits and bobs that happened, but the roof was too thin. It wasn't insulated. There was no equipment. It was literally, when I first started here in 99, the amazing Torquil Norman, Sir Torquil Norman, had bought the building in 96 to turn it into what it is today with his family trust, the Norman Trust, which he had put all the money into. And that had bought the building, and then it bought this piece of land next to the Roundhouse, and then we raised £33 million to rebuild the Roundhouse, which, of course, that was back in 2004.
Right.
So think of it now.
In today's money, yeah.
And the whole idea was to pull all those services, bars and toilets and stuff, out of the main building as much as possible. So when you go in there, you just see the Roundhouse. Then those bridges were to take you from the real world, again, suspending your disbelief. You literally walk across a bridge of light, because it is light. You can kind of see through it, into this unreal world, which of course is so much more real than, you know, if we're thinking about our humanity, it's so much more real than maybe having a drink at a bar.
Yeah, right. That's a lot to think about, metaphorically and spiritually.
But it's really amazing. I didn't know that that was the sort of thinking behind the architecture, but it's exactly what I felt. And I suppose that, you know, it just shows how much it works. I mean, I didn't realise I was being manipulated, Marcus.
Yeah, but you're so spiritually aligned, Lucy. That's why you do such a great job.
The mind games.
Yeah.
But it'd be interesting just to talk about that period from like the 80s to 96, where the building was not being used as a music venue, because there was some interesting stuff that happened at the time. Obviously, there was filming done here, but also there was like a bit of rave culture kind of permeated the building, didn't it? There was the legendary Spiral Tribe.
I have a friend who was there for one of the days of their week-long rave in the new year between 92 and 93, something. Early 91,
90s, 92. Yeah, maybe 90 to 91, 91, 92. It was a New Year's Eve party.
But didn't sort of
obviously
stop.
It was a free party, wasn't it? So it was...
Yeah.
It was meant to be one night and stayed for a week, didn't it?
But her memory of it was it was filthy. I mean, really fun. Well, really the fun and, be, and most cool thing. But yeah, there wasn't infrastructure there. I mean, it just was.
There wasn't.
Toilets.
No.
Yeah. No.
No. Even when I first arrived, we had portaloos outside and they'd been bought very cheaply from a race course. And one day, one person went to them and literally they fell through the floor.
Oh, my God.
And luckily, there was nothing inappropriate happened. but, you know, that did kind of say that the whole place needed to be rebuilt. Because actually, there was a huge fondness for the place and that legendariness about the roundhouse lived on. And then we had to come with a new vision. And the new vision was all about our work with young people and so on. Yeah.
So that segues quite nicely into the trust. You know, the work that the trust does and the ethos behind it. So could you tell me a little bit more about when the Roundhouse Trust and that focus to empower and enable young people within the arts kind of came into being and
it was built
and what
in,
it means?
Designed from the very beginning, right, Marcus? I mean, that was the whole purpose of when we were reopened. That was always, you know, central to what we were going to be as an organisation. It wasn't a music venue that we later sort of added a charitable remit to. Like, that's really, it's always been integrated. For that reason, it is authentic. It feels, you know, it's not been sort of shoehorned in later. So, you know, a lot of people don't realise when they come to a gig at the Roundhouse that underneath their feet are 20-something state-of-the-art studios that young people can rent for, you know, £1 an hour, effectively. And that people like Little Sims or Nubar Garcia or Ezra Collective, you know, have come and started in their earliest days making music here, you know, and still to this day we have, is it 8,000 young people this year?
Be more than that, actually.
Okay.
We're saying 8,000, but it's actually going to be more. It's going to be amazing.
You know, who take part in the creative projects we offer, not just music, lots of different, you know, creative disciplines, but, you know, come and learn to DJ or be a producer, or they could be part of our music collective, or, you know, we have a resident artist program, you know, and that is really integrated with what we do because, you know, for example, our residents get performance opportunities during In the Round. So they'll be opening some of the shows and some of the artists.
What's In the Round?
It's one of our festivals and it's 9 shows presented around a round stage, fully seated. And it's really amazing for those more intimate things that, you know, might not work quite so well with a standing audience, basically. It allows us to do a kind of really broad range of different genres, you know, cult artists and things. Like, we've got Lonnie Holly and Matina Roberts, for example. And, you know, that's a really, really special artist. He's worked with Cat Power and Michael Stipe. And he's really, really celebrated. And I think we're going to look back on that show and sort of appreciate how special and how lucky we were to have him in the building. And you couldn't put him in a 3,000 capacity standing room.
Yeah, sure.
It just wouldn't work. You know, we've also got Samara Joyce, a sort of 22-year-old, incredible jazz musician, singer. So she'll be performing with an octet as part of the series. We've got Terza, Vashti Bunyan, so sort of all different generations represented. We've got a very special show that our young people are involved in. So sort of going back to trying to sort of where we link the music that happens in the main space to the activity with our young people. Our vocal ensemble are working, you know, as we speak on the kind of vocal arrangements and presentations that will be part of that show. So they're going to be some of the artists performing that, people like Emily Sandé, Bombay Bicycle Club, Sam Amidon.
Amazing.
And, you know, there'll be some very special sort of vocal work happening with them. And actually, the musician who's kind of curating and MDing this show was herself a Roundhouse alumnus. She came and learned to deliver, you know, did music facilitating courses here as well. So there's these really sort of wonderful links back
to... It's full circle.
Yeah.
And that's really beautiful.
Yeah.
And in terms of some of the alumni, you kind of touched on Lil Sims and you touched on Nubia Garcia and a few others. Like, who are a few other, like, recognisable names?
Ray.
Wow. Okay, well, she's, obviously very current at the moment. We're off to her Brit Awards. She cleaned up there.
Oh, yeah. We love her.
So she came and used the studios and utilised the trust.
Yes, and I guess was part of the kind of music community in her early days that we supported here.
Amazing.
Freya Ridings. Have I mentioned Ezra Collective?
That's actually a gig that I had tickets for, but I didn't go.
Oh, no.
I couldn't go. And I wish I would have gone and seen that gig. Yeah, because they're doing amazing things. So the Ezra Collective came through.
Femi was, one of the, he used our studios and, I think was involved in different kind of, was he part of our music collective at the time? I'm not sure. We had a a jazz, it was known as our jazz collective at that point. And so that was, yeah, a real hotbed for people like, yeah, Femi from Ezra Collective, Nubai Garcia. I mean, these are just the people we sort of, the names we know of.
Yeah,
I mean, the whole,
yeah.
I'm forever bumping into people who tell me that they, you know, came and made music here or,
our
you know,
records aren't that great from those days, I've got to say. Our alumni records, and now loads of them are really famous, but in the other bits of the world, we have Jack Rook, who is a writer. He wrote Big Boys and Channel 4 BAFTA nominated. Okay. Daniel Kaluuya, who's amazing. Oscar winner, and many others. But
also, not even like the artists in the performance sense, but like the production sense. There must be so many people who have come through who are running.
Just, we're sitting in a podcasting studio. Huge numbers of people working in podcasting and radio came through our work.
Production, here. Presumably, as well.
Production, exactly. I think it's really good that you mentioned that, because it'd be missing the point of what the Roundhouse is about if it was all about the few famous names. And it's really great. We find so often that there are people who've become teachers or gone into other areas of work. They built their confidence, raised their self-esteem, learned skills, gained experience. And that pipeline got them into the industry, into 100%. The creative industry. So whether it's technical or being on stage or one of our kind of jobs, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, or just being part of the community and being exposed to that energy is so important.
With the values of, you know, so often they sort of go, yeah, I just want to give something back. And you sort of go, well, keep going with your career because it's really good, and that's giving back because it's brilliant at the moment.
That's great. That's admirable, and I think that's really cool. And from a venue point of view, it's there's not many other venues, I think, who have that inbuilt infrastructure.
Yeah, I think for a start, we're very much the, you know, our youth program is the biggest for a start, but really it is, it wasn't something we added later to meet very admirable objectives. It really is what we are.
It's who you are. It's part of the DNA of the building.
Yeah.
That's great. So moving back to kind of like the live element, a couple of questions for you, random questions, but it'd be interesting to get your thoughts.
Do we get a buzzer?
You can. Well, there's some sound effects on this thing, but I don't know if I want to.
Do we
play
get points? And are there prizes?
Of course, there are points. Of course, there are prizes. We can talk about those later. Going out to all three of you, which artists, alive or dead, would you have most liked to have seen perform at the Roundhouse?
I know.
Go on, you go and give us time to think.
Well, there are two. I'd love to have seen Stevie Wonder here.
Oh, wow.
And I'd love to
it's
see...
It's not too late with Stevie. You never know. He might...
Yeah, well, that would be fantastic. And I do like Nina Simone. So can you imagine the lights go down, you're in a seated in the round show, and it's just Nina Simone there, and the whole thing is dark and mysterious and beautiful. And I think that would live on. I was very lucky, I should just say, I'm going to let the others answer their question, but when you're thinking... A number of years ago, we had the BBC Electric Proms here, which is just fantastic. And the director of the BBC Electric Proms, a woman called Lorna Clark, who's actually now on our board here, she and I were allowed to listen to one rehearsal, a three-hour soundcheck rehearsal of one artist. And it's only two of us in the venue with James Brown.
Oh, wow. Band.
And I've got to say, that lives on almost as one of the most powerful things that I've ever
learned. James Brown?
James Brown, yeah.
Did he do the cloak?
He did the cloak, he did the falling on his knees. It was the last film concert he ever did.
Wow.
And he died a couple of months later, and it was on Christmas Day when he died, everyone woke up in the morning to a picture of him at the Roundhouse. So it was very strange.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, I've answered mine.
I have two. I'm afraid I've given this answer before, but I really am a diehard fan of both these people, so I think I'm going to have to just keep saying the same thing. I mean, alive or dead... I know we had Prince here. I just wish I'd been at that show. That's all.
Yeah.
I saw him down the road.
Good,
but, oh, shut up. Oh, wow.
Don't rub it in. Yeah. I never saw him because he did a load of gigs in Camden.
Yeah,
didn't he?
Yeah.
Yes.
And he was following the Jimi Hendrix route, wasn't he? So he was like playing at all the venues that Jimi Hendrix played at. So he played at Ronnie's. He did stuff at
Electric Ballroom.
Electric Ballroom.
To that one. That was wonderful.
Were those the gigs that they were like non-publicised and you found out on the day? And, yeah.
Ooh, I will forever be in the debt of Trina at the Electric Ballroom who got me into that
show. So you have seen Prince, but just not at the Roundhouse.
Just not here. I want to see him here.
Beggars can't be choosers. I never saw him. Yeah.
I couldn't get into the Roundhouse Prince show, and I was here.
Wow.
This is disgraceful.
Knox.
The alive people, still alive, thank goodness. I really would love to see Dolly Parton and or Iggy Pop.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Love them. Great choices.
They were just either one. Double bill, ideally.
Yeah. Iggy Pop, I could definitely imagine it around that.
Come
100%.
On.
Yeah.
Well, let it be known. We want them.
What about you, Ruth?
I mean, typically going third. You've both nicked both.
Sorry.
No, I'm a kind of big Motown fan, so I'm following suit with you. But and Prince, obviously, what a missed opportunity there for me. Like Louis Armstrong.
Armstrong, yeah. Oh, my God.
He was our first
amazing.
Dance at the wedding, so it would have to, you know, something like that.
I once saw Etta James and the Five Blind Boys of Alabama doing a concert, and was like, you know... I mean, it was like I had a facelift by the end. The force of it was incredible. It's like just extraordinary.
Where was that?
That was a Brighton Conference Centre.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Of all places.
Of all the places. Yeah.
That esteemed.
It was amazing.
And some of you have kind of answered the next question, which was the best gig that you missed. So you mentioned Prince.
I think Feist. Recently we had Feist come through.
That was just so good.
Yeah, just kind of an most incredible setup, satellite stages, and so technically kind of ticking lots of boxes, but a real, real performer, like just taking it to the next level, wandering about, use of space, amazing use of light, you know, ticking all my techie boxes. But yeah, it was the one when you come in the following morning into the office and everyone goes, oh my God, you should have been there. You should have been there.
That must happen most days though, right?
Pretty much. Yeah.
I mean, like, it must be hard.
We never sleep.
Yeah, right. I mean, like, who's playing tonight? Echo and the Bunnymen. You've got to see that if you work here, of course.
Yeah.
I was just thinking of the one that I missed, and it was because I was too young, which was the Led Zeppelin. You mentioned Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
I'm doing that for my board member, Nick Allott, who absolutely loves them. But when they came back to the O2 and did that gig, I could have gone, and I could have gone to see Kate Bush as well, but I just kind of had them pictured in my mind at a certain time, and I kind of didn't want to change that picture. Although now I've really kicked myself because I love Kate Bush.
Of course.
Yeah.
Amazing. And another thing that I wanted to talk about and kind of bring into the roundhouse is Camden as an area. Because obviously there's so much history in Camden, musically, from a counterculture point of view, in terms of, like, you know, the personalities and the characters and everything that kind of it stands for historically. Funny enough, I used to go to school in Camden. Yeah, on Camden Road I went to school. And I didn't know about the trust at the time, and I wish I had done. This was like, you know, 20 years ago. I'm showing my age, 20, 25 years ago, but I wish I would have utilised this space as a teenager instead of roaming the markets and the canals and whatnot. But yeah, going back to the area, how much of Camden's energy and, you know, from a musical point of view, do you think has influenced the Roundhouse?
I think at certain times it has.
Yeah.
And I think the market has an important role to play in that. When it was at its kind of founding days and the Roundhouse at its founding days, that must have been a very extraordinary,
exciting, vibrant time.
Vibrant time, because it was quite cheap, I think, in those days. Just a few people with tables and stuff, and it was redundant buildings, and people have a go. That's why the Roundhouse worked really well as a performance space, because they didn't want to go to the red velvet theatres, and it was the only place that you could really go. So that's why it became a counterculture place. And it was in a really run-down area. This was really run-down. Even when I started in 99, most of the buildings in this area have now been changed or completely knocked down, done up. And the remaining ones are about to go down and come back up again. When the market
is good and bad with that.
Yeah.
In my mind, there's probably more bad, I think, in terms of, like, the feel of a place and the history. And
I think
it's good to regenerate and kind of...
Regeneration is good in many ways, as long as it is regeneration and not the other. And I think young people need to feel safe, but they also need to experience the world.
Yeah.
And Camden Market has always been a place where it feels a bit edgy. It feels maybe to some people, they say, a little bit corporate now, and it's very clean and very tidy, very well managed. That's really great. You can still get a few of the T-shirts and the socks and everything else that you might want to and hang out and get some food, which is quite cheap. And it's a really wonderful experience for teenagers. But I suppose the whole world has changed. So that feeling of, like, real bravery going somewhere has changed a bit as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's sanitised? It's becoming a bit more sanitised, potentially, in terms of what it used to be, Camden Market.
I think we all are a bit.
Because,
you know,
you're probably
can't smoke drugs here. And in the old days, I suppose it was, if you didn't, you're in the wrong, you know.
I think that it's
that was actually my next question as well. But
when can you smoke drugs at the Roundhouse?
Never.
Not for want of trying for most of the lineup, but yeah.
Definitely.
I think at this point we've got to do a shout out to our volunteers,
right?
Because they're our Roundhouse ambassadors. So we've got 130, 40, 50 volunteers that work with our visitor services team, and they are majority Camden based. Wow. You know, they all come and give their time and they'll steward for us. They'll, you know, show people to seats and do a bit of welfare and kind of signpost people and that kind of thing. But they're all majority from the local area.
And they look and feel like Camden, don't they?
That's it. There's Camden in the roundhouse all the time. And it works both ways. We adore them, we love them. But also they leave going, oh my God, the roundhouse is the most incredible thing. I saw this, I did that, you know. And that's, we are Camden because of our volunteers.
Well, it's the people
we serve.
It's the people, isn't it?
Yeah.
That make an area. And if you can kind of, if they're part of the experience of the roundhouse.
You're completely right. It is that feeling that they are there. They're the constant, actually. Many of us are not.
Mm.
But the other thing is we're not in a postcode. We're not in a housing estate. We're not in a business area. We're actually a little island between a road and a railway. We are literally a little island with nothing else on it. There's an office block next door. But otherwise, we're independent. We are independent foundation. We're independent spirited. We are not controlled by a corporate or a, other funding body. We have wonderful support from many people and the Arts Council and so on. But actually, we're a free spirit. We're independent. And so we can really say what our voyage is going into the future.
And you've got control of that. In an authentic way, I mean, have there been like overtures from the corporate world and from kind of like bigger brands to try and kind of align themselves with the venue that you've had to kind of like say no to protect that?
There have been a number of brands which have tried to buy us and literally said, how much is it? And I sort of go, well, it's X thousand a night. And they say, no, how much is it? And that's happened 3 times since I've been here. And there have been some big brands, but we're not going to be change our name. We are the Roundhouse. We're the Roundhouse. And that's why young people like coming here, why independent people come here. They can go off and experience that whole different corporate thing in other venues, and it's great. You know, people have a lovely time, but there's something about the people who work here, the volunteers, and us lot, and the artists that want to be here, because it does retain that kind of counterculturiness, and it is about supporting young people to be that next generation in the creative industries and music and the arts. And they bring everything that they know to that, and that is often not the mainstream.
Right.
So we're there to nurture and support that talent, give platforms to, and sometimes the things we hear, we feel nervous about because it's reflecting in our eyes about, you know, is this regeneration or is this capitalization or is it what is it that's coming into a neighbourhood? And so supporting those artistic, fragile artistic voices to become the Daniel Kaluuya's, the Little Sims, or the people like us or the people working in the technical, it takes quite a long journey. You know, and that's why we've got this new building that we're sitting in now. This was only opened last summer. Roundhouse Works, which is a centre for creative entrepreneurs or a workspace. It's a kind of incubator for young businesses, for young people aged 18 to 30. And we've got some big studio space so we can increase the numbers from, you know, where we are now to maybe even up to 15,000 a year.
Amazing.
Within about 4 or 5 years now.
Wow.
So that's our vision. And then to have the world-class artists performing on our stage all the time in this world-class building with world-class visitor services and everything else in an island of Camden, which is vibrant and different. And, you know, it's still one of the world centres for young people, you know, tourist centres. People come from all over the world to go, where are we going in London? We're going to Camden Market.
It's on the map, isn't it? Definitely. Amazing. And that was kind of like linking in nicely into like people's emotional connection with the Roundhouse. Because, you know, I've been coming here in as a punter for many years. And it's always like, you know, I love lots of different venues for lots of different reasons. But the Roundhouse does have like a particular magic associated to it. And I think when you spoke about the bridge, that kind of was a nice metaphor for it. But people do seem to have, and I'm not just trying to blow smoke up all your asses, but people do have a real emotional connection and a fondness with the space. Which I think is a very special thing in a world that is becoming a little bit more sanitised.
Yeah, I've definitely obviously been drinking the Kool-Aid, but also the fact that, you know, we seem to be at these sort of intersections of, are we the biggest small venue or the smallest big venue? I just don't, like, we've got
both.
We're both. That kind of intimacy.
What are you talking about?
It's the Kool-Aid.
It's the Kool-Aid again. That feeling of you, like, it's feeling overwhelmed by the scale of, like, being surrounded by, you know, 2,999 other people, but also feeling like that you're that close to the stage and the artist that you love at that moment. I don't think, I'm very biased, but I can't really remember having a similar experience anywhere else. It's yeah, there's nowhere else really quite like it. It might be something about our kind of our shape.
Yes,
but
I
also
think it is.
The shape helps, but the history is really 100%. Important too, that kind of resonance we were talking about before. And then the fact that we have such a broad variety of different kinds of music that, like, it addresses so many different subcultures and people's tastes. And there's so many, you know, every night of the week you could be brought together with, you know, a gazillion other amazing fans. Like, the shows that, like, you know, stand out in my mind are the ones where you are surrounded by fans who know every single lyric of
every,
the song. That
every song.
Yeah, they're really, that energy, there's nothing else quite like it. And I feel, you know, you can get, live music is wonderful wherever you see it, but there is something very special about the Roundhouse. And I think about the gigs I came to before I worked here, like MF Doom or...
Oh, wow, yeah.
That was just like, oh, and Radiohead. And I think I just cried the entire way through the show. There's something about our...
You and 2,999
we
other
were all
people,
just
yeah.
weeping from the first bar of the first song. Yeah, it's really, it's a really, really special
so
space.
How does that, like, obviously having come here and have that connection, and then in terms of your role as head of music, in terms of, like, strategizing who comes or selecting the artists and the performers, how do you kind of formulate that creatively? Or is it with a view to kind of like selling tickets, or is it a view to like curating a certain artistic
lineup,
or is it just instinct? Or
it's a blend of lots of things. I mean, the career I've had prior to coming to the Roundhouse involved me having gone to, I think, 10,000 shows over the course of my time. So I have now a kind of feeling about what is going to connect with people live or not. And yeah, so there's that, but really, obviously, we want to make sure the room is full as much as possible for the promoter's sake, as much as our own. But there's also kind of an artistic sensibility that we want to address. We want to make sure that kind of we want to feel like London. We want to feel like everything is represented here. You know, every kind of taste constituency, every kind of person. You know, and I think try and make sure the programme is as broad as possible. Yeah, that's just, I think, what we always have in our minds in the programming team, you know. And that means that we can have things that are kind of hugely popular and exciting and wonderful, but they still have an amazing kind of unique artistic quality. And I was thinking about Rina Sawayama and her show and how that was just such a special moment from a kind of feeling of community. And like the songs are amazing, the visuals are amazing, the kind of atmosphere, she's an incredible artist. That was one of the ones where everyone left like singing, and the kind of pitch of fan sound was just so special. Yeah, I think PJ Harvey, I mean, yeah, like there's a huge range of, I'll also tell you that when I was talking to my team prior to coming into this interview, like, what are your highlights? One of them was Sting and Shaggy.
Wow, so, amazing.
We've had everything good, and we love them.
I mean, it was good.
They did a, did you see their Tiny Desk concert?
No.
They did a Tiny Desk. Funny.
Yeah,
I love that.
It's good,
So, there's a whole, you know, a huge range of different kinds of music, and we're just omnivores, you know.
That's really cool. I'm quite jealous of your job. I think you've got a cool job.
I have the best job in
London. A nice way. Yeah.
I think there's something in that as well, which is about making sure that we represent London and we feel like London. Mm. When you come in, it's not some highly corporate place, but it feels like London. And, you know, that changes over time, and being linked in, coming back to your volunteers point. And, you know, the offer that we give and the visitor service experience and everything else that goes alongside it. It has to be as good as what you see on stage. If it's not, then you kind of go...
Well, it's all part of the experience, isn't it?
Yeah. You clean toilets. Sorry, you know, to mention that, but, you know...
That often, doesn't feel like very London to me, but...
Often we get notes back saying how well looked after we were, and, you know, you've got the cleanest toilets in London, you know. So, and we're proud of that too.
That's good. You learned from the Portaloo experience, yeah.
I certainly did, yeah. Yeah, there's some stories around that, which I'll have to tell you another time.
Off air. Wow, well, we've covered so much. I feel like we could probably continue talking for another couple of hours. But just in terms of like the future for the Roundhouse, I mean, it feels like it's in very good hands, and it feels like, you know, the ethos and the energy and the spirit is very kind of easy to understand. Like, what's the plan for the next year, 5 years, 10 years, just to kind of keep maintaining and being true to
Can I jump in very quickly?
Yeah.
We've done some mega things in the last year, like opening this building, which is a 10-year project, really. We've appointed Daniel Kalua as Associate Artistic Director. And so what we're doing is developing projects with him. And what we want to do is to do what we do now, more focused, clearer and punchier and better, and to be known by everybody as the world-class space that people can come to. Now, with work with young people, we want those young people that take part to go and be ambassadors of what we do, and we want them to have a pipeline into the industry, have real experience and get jobs. Now, we've just done some social return and investment work on some of our programs, and the results coming back from that are quite staggeringly good. So we want to do more of that kind of thing to show the world that by doing this kind of work, it needs investment, but we should be doing this for every young person around the country. Everyone should pick up this baton, and amazing. We can help them do it.
So is it something that you can see being taken, like the system that's in place, being taken to other cities?
Wouldn't it be great? Can you imagine if we name a couple of the Jack Rooks or the Little Sims or the Daniel Clues. This is really extraordinary, diverse in every sense, you know, class and everything else. Talent that wouldn't have found its way, might not have found its way.
100%.
And, you know, we're all born, you know, all five of us in here were born with the same amount of talent. It's just that opportunity is scattered randomly. Mm-hmm. And what we've done and what we're doing at the Roundhouse is enabling everyone, every young person, not dependent on where they came from or anything else, to find that talent and
what that niche is within themselves.
And then to go and have a fantastic life doing it. You know, it's not a dream, it's a reality. We've got the proof that shows it.
And so true. Just in terms of I agree with 100% with what you say, that everybody's born with the same amount of talent, but like some people just aren't exposed or in the right environments to kind of like unearth that.
I feel like I've been thinking about it just listening to our conversation. You can feel a lot on your shoulders, right, in terms of the history and the art and all of that. And that custodian factor, I think, is so key, that you don't listen to that pressure, you don't listen to that history. Of course, it informs. But we're custodians of the Roundhouse, and we really owe it to the next generation and all of these artists that will be in the future. That's why we keep going. That's why we do what we do. It's for the young people.
Amazing. I think that's a really nice way to cap it off. But thank you all for your time. It's been really, really interesting and informative. And can't wait for my next gig here.
Yeah, you're always welcome. Yeah, Jeremy, thank you so much. Yeah, it's really interesting. I've actually loved the chat.
It's brilliant. Great. Yeah, no, it's been great to have you. You've been very informative. And I can't thank you enough. All right, cool.
Thank you.
Thank you.